Welcome to another episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated, the podcast. I'm your host, Claire Malky. If you're listening to this episode on its initial release date, then you'll know that today is Black Friday, a phenomenon in American culture where we spend a shit ton of money to get a jump start on holiday shopping. Right, because the true meaning of Christmas is consumerism. But that's another episode. Probably actually a whole other podcast. Anyway, if you're wondering why it's called Black Friday, it comes from a term accountants use to signify growth in profit, aka in the black. Conversely, losing money is called in the red. If you're familiar with Black Friday, then you're probably also familiar with Small Business Saturday. It's the same sort of idea, but instead of shopping at Macy's, maybe you shop at your local artisan clothing store or get curbside pickup. There is still a pandemic after all. Anyway, what you might not realize is that this podcast is a small business, and our products are our episodes. And the amazing thing about them is that you can listen to them all for free. What a bargain. So this weekend, it would mean the world to Mike and I if you post about this show on your social pages or share the podcast with a friend. Or if you've given up on social media altogether, first off, I don't blame you. But secondly, you could post a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It would really help our show grow. Thank you so much. Now, since Americans are literally obsessed with Black Friday shopping, we figured today was the perfect episode to chat about the economy. We know this is a hefty subject, but remember, this podcast is a launching pad. If you ever want to learn more about a topic, go ahead and open your laptop and Google it. In the spirit of diving deeper into subjects, we need to issue a correction from last week's episode. Our interview guest last week, Andrew Cashuni, kindly pointed out that we incorrectly said that the Spanish flu was named because its first outbreak was in Madrid. This is false. The Spanish flu most likely originated in Haskell County, Kansas, a couple hundred miles away from Fort Riley, the U.S. Army base where the first outbreak was reported back in March of 1918. Spanish flu is actually a misnomer. Because Spain was neutral during World War I, they didn't censor their press, thus allowing them to report the news of the flu pandemic first before anyone else could. That's why it's called Spanish flu, because many people thought it first came from Spain, when it was just that the Spanish were the first to report it. Thanks for that update, Andrew. We have got an excellent show in store for you all today. As always, we'll begin with this week's top headlines. Then we'll dive into the economy. And then we'll top off the show with my interview with Darden School of Business MBA student Angus McIntyre. They say the best way to cure a Thanksgiving hangover is to keep drinking. So grab your Bloody Mary and let's get started. Up first, this week's headlines. Was yesterday, but Black Friday has been the whole month of November. I'd say the biggest winner there was the coronavirus, who clearly used Black Friday to buy all of its Christmas presents early. This was Donald Trump's last year taking part in his favorite presidential pastime, pardoning turkeys with silly names. This year, their names were Corn, Cobb, and Michael Flynn. After a three-year hiatus, Twitter announced it will allow influencers to apply for the coveted blue verification checkmark, which will have to replace the verification of Dad saying, "I'm proud of you." This week, the Trump administration approved the start of the formal transition to the Biden administration. With this announcement, Trump will also begin his formal transition from president to inmate. The Biden administration announced it will nominate Janet Yellen as the Treasury Secretary, the role once held by Alexander Hamilton. With Yellen's nomination, it looks like women were finally included in the sequel. Work! Along with Yellen, Biden has chosen Anthony Blinken to be his Secretary of State, John Kerry as his climate czar, and Jake Sullivan as National Security Advisor, among others. a radical move considering that none of these nominees are related to Biden, have paid money to Biden, and that all they have to offer up to the job are years of experience. GM has dropped its support of Trump's climate policy to align with the Biden administration. In climate terminology, we call this brown nosing. Despite approving the Biden transition, Donald Trump's campaign continued to target black cities to overturn the election results. And experts have just realized why. Trump still thinks their votes only count for 3/5 as much. This week, AstraZeneca announced its COVID vaccine is not only easy to produce, but is also quite effective, making AstraZeneca the Malort of vaccines. And if you don't know what Malort is, you'll love it. In response to a spike in coronavirus cases, Pennsylvania issued a curfew prohibiting the sale of alcohol after 5 p.m. This comes as upsetting news to college students, alcoholics, and Alan Jackson fans. A mysterious monolith was found in a canyon in Utah. I would say this makes sense, as from my experience, people from Utah are used to living with poles in their crevices. On Tuesday, Elon Musk became the world's second wealthiest person, surpassing Bill Gates, living up to the age-old proverb, first is the worst, second is the best, third is the one who still has $118.5 billion net worth. And that was this week's headlines.
Up next, this week's deep dive.
Now, we must first start by saying the economy is a huge, broad, sweeping topic. It is a massive subject that has sections upon sections of high school, undergraduate, and graduate level classes dedicated to its study. But none of that really explains what the economy is in any sort of tangible, substantive way. At least, not for our purposes. So I guess what I want to dive into today is, how do we measure the economy? And what is it exactly that politicians point to when they talk about it? Also, why do people just take them at their word? We'll delve into these big questions with our interview guest today, but here are some pointers to get started. The very first thing people tend to talk about when trying to define how to measure an economy is GDP, which is basically the grandparent to WAP, WAP. GDP stands for Gross Domestic Product. According to the fun minute-long video on Investopedia.com, the GDP is the total dollar value of all goods an economy produces over a total period of time. So it's basically like Catan. Red player has a good economy because a lot of fives have been rolled, and blue player has a bad economy because they thought they could get away without building a settlement on any clay spaces and cornered the market on hay. Rookie mistake, blue. But basically, what they're saying is that if the GDP has risen 3% from last year, then the economy has risen 3% from last year. Right, but still, how do we measure that? Well, there are apparently two approaches, the income approach and the expenditures approach. The income approach is measured by adding up all the record earnings for the year, and the expenditures approach is measured by adding up what everyone spent. Of course, then we have to consider what the factors are that led to income and expenditures in general. A healthy economy is supposed to be indicated by low unemployment and growing wages. Companies spend money to pay employees, and employees spend money on goods and services, which are made by companies. And the more money that employees make, the more money they will spend on goods and services, and the more money the corporations make. Right? Except the idea behind that is then handicapped by another factor of how the economy is measured, and that is inflation, which is a general increase in prices and fall in the purchasing value of money. This would be like in a game of Catan, when everyone has sheep, but no one actually needs sheep. So literally every time someone goes to trade, it's like, yeah, anyone want some sheep? I'll give you 3 sheep for 1 ore. Anyone? Nope. Okay, well, I'm just gonna play this knight card then. God damn it, another sheep? Anyway, corporations see people making more money, and so they figure they too can make more money by charging more for their goods and services. We'll touch on this further in the interview. Don't worry. Another buzzword that you'll hear get thrown around is volatility. A quick Google search will tell you that volatility is the liability to change rapidly and unpredictably, especially for the worse. Since we're going with this Catan metaphor, think of it this way. You could have a high volatility rate if you only build your settlements on tiles with brick and wood. Sure, you've got lots of materials to build roads, but what happens when your arch nemesis puts a robber on your only wood tile? And now you're stuck because you have no way to grow your settlements. And for some reason, you can't roll a 7 unless you're only holding 9 cards. But as we know, no settlement means no cities, which means no W for your gameplay. I apologize if any and all of those Settlers of Catan references went over your head. It really is a great board game. Maybe look into it if you're home with some family over the holidays. Possibly even a purchase for Black Friday. So, why is it important to learn about the economy? Well, because it encompasses a huge portion of our everyday lives. And it quite literally affects all of us. Even the super wealthy can be toppled by a struggling economy. Understanding how this economy we live in affects you will help you fine-tune your financial decision-making skills and even help you gauge your role in our greater society. There's still so much more out there about the economy, including models, theories, practices, and related topics such as the unemployment rate, the stock market, and the cheap section on airplanes. But the best part about understanding the economy and how it's measured is it may even help you win Settlers of Catan. Up next, my interview with Darden School of Business student, Angus McIntyre. All right, so for today's interview, we have Angus McIntyre. He is currently an MBA student at the Darden School of Business at the University of Virginia. Wahoo wah. And he has a BA in economics and a minor in business from Northwestern and has been a consultant for a couple of different companies, including Deloitte and now Bain & Company. Thank you so much for being on Sit Still, Look Opinionated, Angus.
thank you, Claire. I'm super, super excited to do this. This is going to be a great conversation, and I'm very thankful for you having me.
Yeah. Angus is an old friend of mine, and I'm super excited to kind of pick his brain about the economy. So, speaking of which, we are talking about the economy, and we know this is a very big, broad subject. And so, in sort of like an elevator pitch way, how would you describe what the economy is or what it does?
Yeah, so the economy, I would say, pretty much spans everything that everyone does in a given day. And that sounds super scary and large, and that's because it really is. I mean, in its most simplistic form, it's basically just the economics. It's just the study of how two or more parties interact, you know, whether it's buying or selling goods, services, knowledge. It's basically, you know, the official definition is how people interact with scarce resources, particularly regarding producing, distributing, and consuming goods and services. So, you know, when you think about your everyday life, you interact with a lot of microeconomies that ultimately make up the macro big E economy. You know, you buy coffee from a coffee shop, you take the train to work, you produce or distribute something at work, whether that's a physical good, some kind of service, something intangible like knowledge. And then, and someone on the other end is buying that good, service, or knowledge. So, you know, the economy is just almost a marketplace, if you will, where people can trade any sorts of things in exchange for other things, most commonly money.
Yeah. I feel like that is something that, like, the economy is money, but it's also so much more than that. It's like how everything in this big world works together and, like, functions.
Yeah. Yeah. The money piece of it is just the common, like, the common denominator. It's the easiest thing to transfer between two people because it's something that the value is kind of universally agreed upon. Mm-hmm. You know, different currencies have different values, but that's just why money is so common. It's harder to trade, you know, my used laptop for your lamp, but you could buy my laptop with your money, and I could buy your lamp with my money.
Oh, yeah. I guess that kind of makes sense. Like when you think back to like elementary school and you're talking about like bartering, that's like kind of like in the past, and now we've moved into this like monetary system.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I also realized I kind of skipped a question. Could you give us a little bit about your like background, who you are, a kind of like intro in that sense too?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, pursuing my MBA right now at Darden, I am likely going to be focusing on global business, business analytics, and entrepreneurship in some capacity. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised in Brooklyn, spent some time in London as well, which was a great way for me to sort of develop a global mindset, which is very necessary when you think about economics, because when you think about economies, it's not just within, let's say, the US economy, people trading, bartering, what have you. It's across borders and truly global nowadays. So that was really a really good experience for me. Went to a pretty small middle school and high school. So, and having spent a lot of my time in the Northeast, wanted to try something new. So I ended up at Northwestern University in Chicago for undergrad, where I actually majored in economics and got a minor in business as well. After Northwestern, I joined Deloitte as a consultant, as you said. I was actually working on projects where I was helping clients think through various people-related issues. So whether that's compensation, performance management, org structure, career, like employee career pathing, anything around the people side of things at businesses. I did learn a ton there, and it was a great experience, but felt that these issues weren't necessarily my calling, and I wanted to be somewhere on the outward-facing side of the business, you know, how organizations either make money or achieve their goals, whatever they are. So that's why I came here, got my MBA at Darden, or I'm getting my MBA at Darden, and then why I'm going back into consulting just on the strategy side to be a little bit more focused on sort of the operations of the business from an external perspective. Mm-hmm.
That's a very complete description, and thank you for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And that is interesting. This, you said you lived in London for a while and had sort of a bigger understanding of the global economy, which is something I feel like me personally and maybe some of my peers sometimes forget that the rest of the world is also like in conversation with America. And in terms of that global economy, is it always run by politicians per se, or is it like dictated by businessmen and like business people, or do the two kind of go hand in hand, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it's a very tough question, because your view on how countries are run is going to be very different depending on what political philosophy you follow and whether you think it, you know, politics are driven by money, which many people can very righteously argue with lobbyists and things like that. I would say that they both go hand in hand, though, because without one, you can't really have the other. All businesses at some point do need to be regulated to protect consumers. The level of regulation, again, depends on your philosophy. So in that sense, businesses need governments. And then in the other sense, governments need businesses, because businesses most times pay a lot of taxes. They employ everyone in the economy. You know, the government can't employ everyone. You know, communism has shown it doesn't necessarily work. So, you know, looking at it from both the business side of view and the government side of view, they need each other. And for that reason, I would say that they go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that definitely makes sense. Earlier in our season, we did an episode on comparing like capitalism, communism, socialism. And we kind of looked at how they have different structures, but they are both trying to achieve, I guess, the same goal of like a working society. And just to clarify, in America, we are capitalist for the most part. I think that's probably a given, but just for our listeners to kind of put this in a silo of where we're talking. So as you were speaking about how businesses and government kind of can go hand in hand and need each other, how is the economy measured? Like, is the government in charge of controlling that measurement, or is it sort of more the businesses are in charge of how it's measured?
Yeah, so the businesses will measure their own contributions to the economy. And when we say economy and how it's measured, there's a number of different ways. Yeah. I think there are four really common ones. The most common of which is GDP or gross domestic products. It's literally just the value of all goods and services made within a country during a specific time period, say a year. You can measure that by measuring the value of what's produced or how much is spent in a given country. Either way, you're gonna get pretty close to the same answer. There's gonna be rounding errors and things like that, but that's really the most common way to measure the economy. With that, businesses will measure their own contributions to that, individuals will as well. And then the way that that is generally reported is through taxes, through surveys that are done by the government, you know, studies done by private organizations that are then released. It's, you know, we would get very much in the weeds if we talk about how it's measured very specifically, but It's then generally the government or some NGO or non-governmental organization, some nonprofit like the World Bank, that also measures GDP or some other measure as well. If you have to assign who's responsible for it, I would say the government, because that's a measure of how well they're doing, how well they're serving their constituents. You know, you could say a lot of different things about other parts, other ways the economy is measured and what makes a successful economy, and we could absolutely get into those as well.
Yeah, that is sort of leading into what this whole episode is about, is sort of how the economy is described and is like sort of related to by politicians or government. It seems like at times a lot of politicians or people in public office are talking about, oh, the economy is my biggest platform, things along those lines. So could you kind of touch on why politicians are always using the economy as a talking point, and why we're so interested in it as constituents and consumers?
Yeah, I think the why is probably just because, you know, if you take the definition of it is all things created in a country, basically, It encompasses everything that is done within a country. So you think about, you know, I think the four main things that you think about when you evaluate an economy are, you know, the GDP, again, gross domestic product, the unemployment rate, inflation, and the stock market. And I think those are really the four things that most politicians talk about, Most people talk about in general, because they're the easiest to measure, the easiest to understand. And they're not the easiest to fix by any means, because they are very nebulous terms, very nebulous things that a lot of people have differing opinions on how to change and influence. But going into each of those a little bit, I already mentioned GDP, but for employment or unemployment, generally, the lower is better, obviously. There is a valid argument for a healthy level of unemployment, somewhere between 3% and 5%, let's call it. And that just ensures that employers can always find someone on the market to fill an open role. If you had full-on employment, 0% unemployment, that would mean that there's actually a shortage of potential employees, and companies would just be stealing talent from each other more than they are already. So there's a healthy level, for sure. As an FYI, when we say unemployment here, we talk about the percent of people who are willing to work. We're not talking about people who are retired, people who are choosing not to work. That's not included in these unemployment figures, and generally never are. If you have, say, in the United States, 100% employment, that's not all 330 million odd people. You have, again, students, people who are not 18, things like that.
That's a really good clarification. That's something I didn't even really realize. Thank you for that clarification.
Yeah, and that's applicable to when they talk about the workforce or the labor force, same thing. It's really people who are actively in the job market. For inflation, a little bit more nebulous, I think. It's really just the natural change in prices over time. And each country has differing opinions on, well, different targets for what their inflation should be. For most developed countries like the United States, like Great Britain, long-term inflation generally targeted around 2%. And that just really means, you know, you want stable growth in prices so people can predict what they're going to be. There isn't high volatility in the market that causes uncertainty. And when you talk about politicians, like, uncertainty is a very buzzy word that they love to bring up. And basically, employment levels are maximized and optimized when things are stable and consistent. Anything higher or lower, you know, if it's higher, that means prices are going to rise dramatically. The value of your money is going to go down because you can't buy as much with the same amount of money. And anything below has pretty drastic effects on the economy. Below 2%, I mean, has pretty drastic effects on the economy that would outweigh whatever drop in prices that you would see. Say, like, if inflation was negative, you would see a drop in prices, but there'd be a whole host of issues that would come up if inflation was that low. And then for the stock market, probably the one that people hear the most out of any of these metrics, basically you, again, want to see steady growth, low volatility, something that's reliable, something that's consistent. Stock market is going up, that's generally a good thing, but going up too fast will raise concerns about a bubble, similar to what happened in 2001 or 2008, where there was a lot of excitement about something and all of a sudden the pillars that thing was built on fell away and everything crashed. So you want steady growth, not exponential growth in a very short amount of time. There are other metrics I have to mention that are important, but that don't always get the same level of attention. Interest rates are one, which is basically just the cost of borrowing money for a house, for tuition, things like that. And inequality, particularly among income or around income, which nowadays is thankfully getting much more attention, but in the US has historically not been something talked about too much. In the UK, I think it's one of their four main targets for their government is to address inequality. So again, we can talk about that more, but that's a big part of when we talk about politics and the economy, that's a big thing that is now coming up more and more.
And when you say inequality, you mean in like wages and earnings and things along those lines in this point of view?
Yeah, and you could even expand that a little bit further to just be inequality in a social setting. So unequal access to healthcare, unequal treatment by the police, everything, again, economy is everything, all and everything in a market, in a country, and all of those things play into the economy, all those things that I just mentioned. So inequality is very broad, but yes, I think most tangibly it is income.
That's also good to know and something to remember in the back of your mind when thinking about the economy in terms of our listeners is like it is, I think I mentioned this earlier, but like it's so much more than every day, like, you know, going to the grocery store or, you know, filling up your car with gas. Like there's a lot more in play from what you've been describing for me so far.
Absolutely.
I had another question that I was thinking about. From what I was hearing when you were talking about the stock market and how you don't want it to grow too fast, and you also don't want it to, you know, slump down, is a lot of working in economics about keeping things on a level ground? Like, is that part of it?
Yes. Yeah, it is. I think that's probably, you know, there are a lot of central banks. So for the U.S., it's the Fed. Basically every country has a central bank that basically controls the flow of money from the government. Again, very, very complex. But the mandate of a lot of central banks is to keep things steady. They have a couple, sometimes a dual mandate, but a lot of times it's to keep things moving on a flat road, slightly uphill, rather than something bumpy where you're going up and down, and it's a lot more work for you. You know, if you picture yourself running on a road, you'd rather have a steady road than something that you're going up and down on. And that volatility, generally the word for that is volatility. That volatility then creates uncertainty. And it's uncertainty where people then start getting really worried. When you talk about the health of economy, another metric is consumer confidence. And if there's uncertainty around, let's say my income, if I'm worried about losing my job because I'm worried that the economy is going to tank, I'm going to stop spending. And when I stop spending, the whole circle of money and the whole circle of goods and values that circle around stops. If you get, you know, not just me, but if you get a couple hundred million people to do it. So that volatility, that uncertainty is really worrisome for a lot of people. And that's part of the goal of economists when they advise the government is to figure out how to keep things relatively in line with targets. You know, you're going to go above and below them, but generally keep them on a smooth path.
What you just mentioned seems very prevalent in this age of COVID and everything that's going on. You know, if you're worried about your income coming in, then you're not going to spend a lot of money and then the whole system kind of stops working. Is that something, too, that politicians want to focus on, you know, that uncertainty is taken care of, if that makes sense?
I want to exclude the years since 2016 and then say yes to that question.
Yeah.
Yes, we can call it my view of the government. But yes, I think generally politicians their goal should be to make sure that their constituents are taken care of, and whatever that means in terms of their ability to spend, their ability to save, their ability to provide. That is generally how they think about their jobs. I think there are plenty of politicians on both sides of the aisle, if you're in other countries, any side of the aisle, since many countries don't have a two-party system, mm-hmm. where they're a little bit more self-serving in their goals, and uncertainty actually helps them. This administration has been very successful in sowing uncertainty into the public eye. And it is lending itself, it's a very smart strategy because it works. I wish it didn't work, but it does. And unfortunately, that's just the reality of where we are today. So to answer your question, long story short, yes, that is generally politicians' goals, to keep things steady, smooth, and reliable. There are some bad actors who break that trend, though.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Yeah, and sort of like leading into our last question about politicians, I guess we might have been answering this so far, but are they always actually trying to tell constituents what's actually happening, or are they trying to keep everything in line from your point of view? We might have touched on that earlier too.
By keep everything in line, what do you mean by that?
Are they actually presenting what is going on with the economy, or are they just trying to keep people from being afraid of the future or like of a crash or something along those lines?
Gotcha. It depends on what message they're trying to tell.
Yeah.
If you are the current administration, you are right now trying to drum up all the good things that you've done for the economy, all the ways that the economy is doing really, really well, all the ways that you've helped it do well, because that supports your goal of being reelected. If you are the current challenger to the administration, you are trying to say, sure, stock market is up, but consumer confidence is extremely low. The growth generally post-recession, and right now we're not necessarily in a recession because recessions are defined by multiple quarters, at least a few quarters in a row of GDP shrinking, and we haven't quite hit that yet, but we certainly will. You are trying to say, okay, when the economy rebounds, because it will within the next, I would call it 12 months, it will probably rebound. That growth after recessions is almost always unequal. The people who can benefit from the growth already have the financial wherewithal, the connections to take advantage of that growth. And often the people who are most hard hit by the recession are the ones left behind. So that is what the current challengers to the administration, I can't bring up a quote from the Biden campaign, but what they will largely probably try to tell is the story of, we have a real risk here of leaving a whole lot of the middle class and the lower class behind. And therefore, the economy can't actually be that good if we're leaving the majority of Americans behind. So that's when I say, like, it depends on, the lens you're taking. Mm-hmm. That's been true throughout history. I can't say that this election is any different. So they tend to focus on different things because their goals are different. And what they value is also different. We can get into like Republicans versus Democrats, what their goal is for the government, but that's sort of my initial thinking.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That was really comprehensive. For our listeners, we have back in season one a whole episode on Republicans and Democrats and sort of what their whole parties stand for, not necessarily politicians. So if you want to check that out, you definitely can. That was for the listeners. But Angus, this has been an amazing interview. You have really opened my eyes to a lot of other things that are going on. If our listeners want to learn more about the economy or feel a little more self-empowered, do you have any resources you would recommend to them?
Yeah, I think what's for those listeners who are not going to be super plugged into like actually wanting to understand the underlying mechanisms of the economy, which is really not necessary for everyday life, I would recommend just keeping up with the news, however you want to do it, whether it's reading newspapers, whether it's listening to podcasts, just anything that gives you sort of that real world example that you can rely on. I will be the first to admit that economics is super dry. So picking up a textbook is not going to be valuable to you, but whether you're reading a really good newspaper like New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Economist, The Financial Times, which are very cheap online now, if not in, you know, in physical form as well, or listening to podcasts such as Freakonomics Radio, which I love, The Daily from The New York Times, which is really good as well. Just keeping up to date on current events, you will by natural osmosis learn about the economy more because it dominates the news cycle right now, as always. And in, you know, any article about most anything, the economy is going to be mentioned and the effects of whatever topic is at hand is going to be mentioned. So it's really just taking the time, learning slowly but surely, and understanding eventually, you know, by Googling things, whatever, if you see a term like inflation is rising, what does that mean in terms of the economy or for your everyday? Or unemployment is dropping, what does that mean for, or rising, let's say, what does that mean for my industry, for my job? And you'll really get the most out of it if you're just staying up to date and active in reading and listening.
That's great. Yeah, we always encourage our listeners to stay up to date. And so that is even another reason to. Well, Angus, thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Claire.
Today's show. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at @sitstill_lookopinionated and on Twitter at @sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and written by myself, Claire Malky, and Michael Dritto. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. Research by Ross Black. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. See you next week. Bye.